Hello, you're listening to Chicago Magazine's podcast, Chefs on the Grill.
4, 3, 2.
One more time.
Hey there, my name is Mike Nagrant, and welcome to the first Chefs on the Grill podcast for Chicago Magazine. This is a collaboration with Hungry Magazine, which you can read at www.hungrymag.com. We expect to bring you interviews with some of Chicago's most interesting chefs and food personalities. You can find all of our interviews at www.chicagomag.com. You can also listen on your computer or download the interviews to your MP3 player and take them with you to make that commute sit by. Or while working out, you can listen to us talk about sinful eats. It's food for the brain, and best of all, it's calorie free. My first interview is with Chef Andrew Zimmerman of Del Toro Restaurant in Wicker Park. Zimmerman grew up in New Jersey and worked in kitchens to support a burgeoning music career that included stints playing for 10,000 in Japan and recording with famed music producer Steve Albini, who's recorded the Pixies, PJ Harvey, and Nirvana. Zimmerman eventually gave up the music gig and graduated first in his class at the French Culinary Institute in New York. He staged at some fine culinary temples, including DB Bistro Moderne in New York City, The Inn at Little Washington in Washington, Virginia, and also Truant Trio here in Chicago. He spent time working with Sandra Gamba at the Park Hyatt, and now he's serving up a refined approach to Spanish tapas at Del Toro. We started out by talking about his early culinary experience.
Were you a food guy growing up?
Yeah, I didn't really realize it, I guess. My mother tells me stories about me being like really young, 5, 6 years old, and once in a great while we'd go out to dinner with my grandfather, he'd come to town. I would always look at the menu and pick the weirdest stuff, like, oh, snails? I'll have those. Mm-hmm. And my mother would look at me like, what, are you out of your mind? If it was something that seemed peculiar, or if I saw it on the menu and it looked expensive, I was going to order that. Oh, that looks expensive. I better try that. I'm not going to know when I'm going to get to do this again, so bring that on. When I was sitting around my house as I got older in my early teens, and I was like, yeah, I don't want to eat this stuff again, Mom. I'm going to go buy a book. I'll be back in a little while. Because I figured, how hard can it be? It's all written down in books, pretty much. All you got to do is read it, and then try it, put it together, and it probably tastes pretty good. Do it.
When you were in Red Bank, did you start taking like forays into the city and looking for food as you were younger?
No, I first started taking forays into the city to check out rock bands, mostly. But my parents started going to New York a lot for business dinners. And I didn't really think much of it at the time, but looking back on it, it seems a little strange that when they'd come home after I'd watch my brother and they'd go out to Le Cirque and Café des Artistes and a bunch of like old classic expensive French restaurants in Manhattan in the early 80s. And I'd always go, what would you have? And I want to know the entire menu, which I don't know why exactly. Like, okay, so yeah, so what? And then what'd you have? How was that? Is that good? How was the sole prepared? That sounds interesting. And did you think it was better than the last place that you went? Okay. Like, I felt like if I sort of heard about it and ate vicariously through them, that then if I ever did get to go to a place like this, I'd be prepared and I'd know what to get and I wouldn't look foolish, you know?
Do you remember what that first book was? You were saying you went to the store to get, you'd be back.
Oh, yeah, yeah. The first one, Paul Prudhomme's Louisiana Kitchen.
Great book.
Yeah, excellent book. I made shrimp etouffee out of it, I think, was the first thing I made, and I thought it was the most brilliant thing ever, which makes sense when you look at the recipe because it's got about 24 pounds of butter in it.
Yes. How old were you when you were doing this, when you started cooking on it?
15.
Yeah.
14 or 15.
It's like the mid-80s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right around when I got my first restaurant job, too.
Yeah.
Which was sort of coincidental. I didn't think I wanted to work in a restaurant. But a friend of mine who had a job in a restaurant called me up one day and goes, yeah, we need a dishwasher. You want a job? And I thought, silly me, that it would beat mowing lawns for the summer.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, yeah, okay. So I got this job as a dishwasher in a horrifically foul restaurant. But they paid me.
What was the name of that restaurant?
The Lobsterman. It was a classic Jersey Shore fried fish and mediocre prime rib kind of restaurant. Dirty old kitchen with a Boeing wood floor, like just a mess. But I went in, it was hot and unpleasant and people were rude, and at the same time somehow I found it amusing.
Mm-hmm.
So I just kept doing that, and then I went from dishwasher to working in the pantry, shucking oysters and clams and plating the pre-purchased desserts, you know, like cutting slices of
Great American Chocolate Cake with ridiculous chocolate chips on top of them, and where putting a squirt of whipped cream next to it and a cherry.
Where was this?
That was at the Lobsterman in Leonardo, New Jersey.
Leonardo?
Yeah.
Was there somebody, you know, I know I worked in a pizza place for 5 years growing up, and it's like, yeah, same kind of deal. There isn't a lot of love in that kitchen, and you know, people are just putting stuff out. But I remember there was a guy for me who did kind of care a little bit and showed me some stuff. And I wonder if there was even somebody there at that early point.
Well, my friend who had gotten me the job, he was really trying to take it seriously, and the rest of the cooks were all a bunch of, like, half high or drunk nutcases. He was taking it kind of seriously. It wasn't until much later that I met somebody who was really, really important in convincing me that I wanted to keep doing this.
That was the Tucenza?
Yeah, that was when I worked for Renato Somela at Tucenza. Because from the time I was about 15 and took the job as a dishwasher at the Lobsterman until I was about 24, I worked in restaurant kitchens because I knew the drill. I liked them. They were flexible and full of characters. And the money was all right. And I didn't have to deal with people, really. Like, I didn't have to sell them something. I just had to make it. When I had an opportunity to go work for Renato, it was sort of one of the reasons I decided to do it was I figured, okay, well, this is a serious kitchen. And if I want to, this will be a good litmus test for whether or not I want to do this professionally and, like, whether I'm going to stick with this or not.
I had read that you you wanted to be a musician as well, right? Is that true?
Yeah, well, that's one of the reasons. It sounds kind of corny, but, I mean, I really worked in kitchens so I could make enough money to buy guitar strings and get a new amp.
I was talking to Graham Elliott Bowles. I know he's a big guitar player, and he was talking, I guess either the maitre d' or somebody who works, I think, in the front of the house is also a bassist, and like they've been joking about starting like the Peninsula Avenues band, you know. But it's funny how many chefs really are musicians or started out as musicians.
It does seem to be a trend.
Yeah.
Well, I think it makes a lot of sense. There's a way of looking at it where it's a very similar thing. You take a bunch of raw materials, whether they're celery and carrots or notes, right, that by themselves are not all that interesting. Mm-hmm. And then if you are able to figure out a way to put those things together in a way that pleases people, they like it, and they think you're cool, and they want to come back and have you do it again. Sure. So in that respect, it's really, I find it to be very, very similar.
So what was the height of your rock success?
The height of my rock success regrettably came too early in my rock career.
Yeah.
In 1989, in my first year of college, the Curiously Strong Peppermints were somehow selected to represent the United States at the 189 World College Pop Festival in Yokohama, Japan. So they sent the whole band to Yokohama and put us up in a hotel. We played for 10,000 people or something in Yokohama Arena, were on television, met the president of Sony Records in Japan, met all these famous Japanese rock stars, which was kind of amusing because we didn't know who they were, so it was like meeting somebody really famous and not being impressed.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't know.
Hey, what's up?
Hey, why do you have a Bert and Ernie puppet on your hand? You people are crazy. Right on. But so, like, that was the drag about that was I was like 18 and getting treated like I was in the Rolling Stones for a week, and then I had to come back to reality, and now I had a taste for, like, I want to do that again. I want somebody to send me here, and let's do this again, because that was cool. Rock and roll.
So you were big in Japan?
Yeah, we were big in Japan for 1 week,
right.
And then that was that.
You and David Hasselhoff.
Yeah, we were huge.
So let's talk Tucenza. When did you start working there? What year was that about?
I'm going to say that was about 96, 97, somewhere around there. I had been increasingly getting more and more interested in cooking. I started to realize that I was spending more of my time wondering about how I could make a certain dish or how I could improve on what I was doing at the restaurant that I was working at, which was like a Southwestern, sort of half Cajun, half Southwestern restaurant.
And I was finding that I was spending more time thinking about food and cooking than I was about, you know, trying to write more songs or, you know, because it was a really, really nice restaurant that cooked really excellent product, wonderful food, always really fresh. And I thought, well, if I can do it there, then I must be pretty good at this, and maybe I should think about sticking with it. And they hired me.
So what was the first thing you were doing there? Was it lying type stuff? Or?
Yeah, well, the kitchen was unbelievably small. It was one jade 10-burner range with two ovens underneath of it. One of the ovens was only like a little half oven.
Renato, he's still kind of your biggest mentor to date. Is that true? Or?
Yeah, because he's the one that I worked. It was a pivotal moment in my career as a cook. And shortly after I started working there, my friend John, who was a sous chef, quit, which meant that I ended up working right next to Renato. It meant that I got to stand next to this guy from Italy who was cooking his food, the food that he grew up with, that he really cared a lot about. You know, it was as good as I could get to being at the source in Italy, almost, like standing next to this guy, asking him about, watching him cook the pasta. And he was also really encouraging of me to come up with ideas for specials and stuff. That was really good because I had lots of ideas. I was really, really excited about this whole cooking thing. And, wow, we can do this. And he's the guy who introduced me to things like, hey, why don't we get a lobe of foie gras and we will make some brioche. And at the time, I thought, like, I'm making brioche, and it's delicious. I'm searing. This guy's giving me foie gras to sear and put on top of the brioche, and it's the best thing I ever ate in my life. And it's just me and him cooking in this kitchen, putting out this food, and people really like it. And it was an open kitchen, too. So I got to know the customers. They'd come in and request stuff that wasn't on the menu, and you'd do it for them. And it was a really sort of idyllic year.
And then you started working at the Grill and the Grape.
I made the decision to take a sous chef job at a restaurant that was opening in Red Bank. In retrospect, it might not have been the best decision, but at the time it sounded really good. The chef who was opening the restaurant was talking a really good game, and we're going to be one of the best restaurants in the state, and this guy's talking really good, and we're going to do all this stuff ourselves, we're going to smoke our own fish, we're going to make our own sausages, you know, everything super hardcore. And I thought, and I get to be the sous chef and I get to make some actual money as opposed to being a slave making no money. It didn't really work out that way.
That was what I thought at the time.
It turned out that knowing what I know now, I might have been better off if I had worked for less money someplace more high profile. It wasn't a bad experience. I learned a lot of stuff that I think was good, a lot of stuff that I don't want to ever do again. Well, let's see. I don't want to be... I learn a lot of things about, like, who to avoid opening restaurants with. Mm. I don't ever want to get tangled up working for the mob. Because eventually the place, while I was still there, was purchased by these guys who... whether or not they really were connected is hard to say. This was, like, really telling me things like, if you have any trouble with the police, you let us know. We have some friends who could fix that for you. Oh, okay. I'm going to run out the back door now and leave permanently. And when I told the guys that I was going to quit, I had been promoted. The original chef had left, and I'd been promoted to chef. And shortly after, about 8 months after the owners made me the chef, they sold it to these guys who came in and immediately wanted me to turn the menu into this, like, classic Jersey macaroni factory, red sauce everywhere Italian restaurant. And having worked with Renato prior to this, there was no way I was going to have any hand in that. And I told him, look, you know, I'm going to leave. I'm going to give you 2 months notice because I want you to have an opportunity to, you know, find somebody else. I don't want to leave you in a lurch or anything, but I'm going to start looking around at maybe going to New York or moving out of New Jersey and working someplace else. And the guys went crazy, like all but threatening me with bodily harm, telling me, you'll never work in this town again. If you ever work in this town again, you're going to be in trouble. I was like, I'm just quitting a restaurant job. Relax. So that'd be one that I wouldn't want to do again.
Yeah, that makes sense. And then you started doing some staging, right? Is that?
Yeah. Then I started going into whatever kitchens I could get into that sounded good. And a lot of it was also looking around for where it was really stages to see what I could pick up and to see where I might want to work. Mm-hmm. And I did a few in New York at DB Bistro Moderne and one of my favorite restaurants in New York, Tabla, which I really, really like. Then I got a call. I was looking at the French Culinary Institute's job postings and I saw that the Inn at Little Washington was looking for help. And I thought, well, that'd be really cool. You know, it's a legendary place. That was a kitchen that you really got the sense like only the absolute perfect best will be good enough. And anything else, just throw it out. Mm-hmm. The quality of the ingredients and the attention to detail and preparation at the Inn at Little Washington were really, really fantastic. It was a really inspiring kitchen to be in.
How long were you there?
I did a 2-day stage there because mm-hmm. I was looking for a job. Mm-hmm. And they offered me the job, and I was going to take it, and I was really excited about the idea of doing it, but it was complete. I would be divorced because the Inn at Little Washington is in the middle of nowhere, literally. There's nothing for miles. Mm-hmm. And my wife and I were trying to figure out a way that we could make it happen. Ultimately, I realized that it wasn't going to be fair for us to move out there because there would be nothing there for her.
Yeah, there's not a lot of fashion design.
No, there's nothing, you know. She would have had to, like, sell bait and tackle at Walmart. I was already starting to get to have to come to the realization that I was, in cooking terms, I was starting to get a little long in the tooth. Mm-hmm. And this was not a place that we could live for a year without it being like too much of a sacrifice mm-hmm. to ask her to make. Mm-hmm. So that is in many ways why we ended up in Chicago, because she's originally from Chicago and I was looking at other cities that we could live in. There were a couple of other contenders, like Portland, Oregon was high on the list, but Chicago just had the highest concentration of really, really excellent restaurants out of any place but Manhattan. And so we figured I'll be able to get a job there. Fine, let's go. Mm-hmm. And that's when I
came out here and
then I went and did 2 days with Grant at Trio, and it was great. I thought it was really, really cool. I was really impressed by how grounded and flavorful and smart his food was. That originally, when I read the menu on paper, I thought, I don't know about this. This sounds like a little goofy.
Sure.
Rosemary vapor and
frozen,
you know,
lettuce.
Like, yeah, frozen lettuce. But then the first night I was there, he was really very, very nice and generous, and I think also incredibly smart. To taste some of these things, which on the surface seemed kind of screwy, mm-hmm. and to see how well they worked together was really good. And then there were some dishes that were just plain good, solid food. Well executed, like a dish of rabbit with a mushroom ragu, was perfect. Mm-hmm. Nothing that you could say about it. It wasn't forward movement, it wasn't strange, didn't have huckleberry soda on top of it or anything. It was just really, really delicious. And I would have been thrilled to have been able to work there. But if I was 22 and lived with four other guys in Wrigleyville, I could have afforded it or something. Mm-hmm. But there was just no way, mm-hmm. no way that I could afford to do it. Mm-hmm. And I wish that I could have, but I couldn't. Mm-hmm. So I had to keep looking around for other jobs. And one thing led to another, and I worked in the kitchens at the Park Hyatt for a while for Sandro Gamba, which was really cool. I had a good time. And at the time, I knew it wasn't going to be a permanent job. It was just I needed to start paying the rent. Mm-hmm. And I met a bunch of guys there that I really liked. One of whom ended up putting me in touch with Terry Alexander because Maude was looking for a chef. And I came over here and Terry hired me, and there you go.
So the staging process, mm-hmm. You spent a couple days or a week in a kitchen, and you spent in some really interesting places. I wonder, you know, how much can you pick up in that kind of time? I mean, is there something you do today that you picked up at the inn at Little Washington, or even in that moment at Trio? Or
when we slice, after we let a piece of meat rest or something and we slice it, we put a seafold towel down and slice the meat on top of the towel, so if there is any blood, like any juice that comes out of the meat, it doesn't go running all over the cutting board. It's just neater.
What's a seafold towel?
It's like a folded paper towel.
Oh, okay.
Like a standard restaurant style folded paper towel thing. And I'd never seen that before until I went and was at Trio, and the guy I was staging with was slicing a lamb loin, I think. And I noticed it, and I thought, that's nice and neat. I'll remember that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, it's kind of a goofy little thing that really...
Sure, ways to work clean, though. Right.
Yeah, it's exactly. It's like a really hyperactive way to work clean. And I thought, that's a good thing. I'll take that. The thing from the inn at Little Washington that I got mostly was just a sense of the deep dedication of the cooks to execute Patrick O'Connell's vision. I try to remind myself of it every chance I get, like what that was like and how cool that was. And Trio was very similar. The cooks were really, really dedicated to executing Grant's vision. And that's a really inspiring atmosphere to be in as a cook, when people are that passionate about trying to do this thing right.
How do those, I can imagine how those kitchens compare. How do they contrast something like Grant versus Patrick O'Connell?
Grant at Trio was running what seemed like a very egalitarian kitchen in many respects. Everybody called each other chef. There was no yelling. There was no Grant walking through the kitchen like he was any more significant a member of the team than anyone else. Patrick O'Connell's got a big painting of himself hanging on one of the walls in the kitchen, you know, which is not, it's not to say anything bad about Patrick O'Connell, it's just a totally different vibe.
Sure.
When you've got this guy with a you know, life-size portrait of himself on the wall, or you've got Grant Achatz polishing the copper on part of the line, and, you know, everybody calling each other chef. That was a big difference.
What'd you pick up from Sandro Gamba? I mean, here's a guy who worked for Ducasse, Robuchon.
I picked up how tasty it really is if you finish risotto with whipped cream, butter, mascarpone cheese, and Parmigiano Reggiano, which Renato never would have done. He would have thought, what are you talking about? This is ridiculous. And sometimes I have to admit, it is a little over the top. You can't, it's like Sandro's risotto, which is very much Ducasse's risotto, is so rich and so over the top. It's really good. That was one.
It's the culinary gilding of the lily.
Yeah, it's really a lot of heavy-duty lily gilding going on there. I had a bachelor's degree with honors in vegetable tournée technique from going to the French Culinary Institute, but working at the Hyatt, I got my master's degree in vegetable tournée technique.
Yeah, can you rock the fluted mushroom?
Yeah, the fluted mushroom. We didn't have to do too many of those. They're a little too old style, you know, but man, tournée baby beets, tournée baby carrots, tournée baby turnips, tournée quince, that is not fun. Quince is the worst thing you could possibly have to tournée ever. It's like trying to tournée a sponge. Unless you just bought your tournée knife and it's like a razor blade, you're done.
Or you got the quince at Jewel and it was super hard.
Because Chandra used to do a lot of shopping at Jewel. He was big on
that. Right, right. I understand. That's where all the chefs are going.
All the chefs are going to Jewel now.
Was he a typical French chef in the sense of, did he have a temperament or...
Yeah.
Yeah.
He could get mean.
Yeah.
I don't think, not like some of the legendary.
Sure.
But
no pans thrown at your head.
No, and he could be really cutting and mean and chop you in half with a couple of words and a look real fast.
So you met Terry Alexander.
Mm-hmm.
And how did you get the mod gig? Did you cook for him?
I came in I think I put together I mocked up a menu for him.
What'd you cook?
I did a roasted pork loin with barley cooked in a risotto style, finished with fiend's herb, some glazed baby carrots, and a dried apricot relish on, or chutney on top of it. I did wild striped bass with corn chowder,
which was it was kind of like a deconstructed corn chowder with wild striped bass and some mussels. Onion and chickpea fritters with cilantro, mint chutney, and I think I did a tomato and goat cheese tart.
The mod, you know, of course, you know, mod became Del Toro.
Mm-hmm.
And I know there's, you know, it's a big shift in style once again.
Yeah.
I know that there's sort of this idea of the trip you took to Spain. I've heard, you know, you were eating like 5 times a day. And
yeah, I crammed in as much as I possibly could because I was only there for a couple of days and I had signed on to write this menu of Spanish food, you know.
What was that like? Was there any iconic dishes, anything that you had to bring back or that you just think about now?
There were a couple. The thing that made the biggest impression on me was roasted monkfish tail. It actually wasn't roasted. It was cooked on a plancha. And it was a monkfish tail cooked on the flat top, put on a plate with extra virgin olive oil and salt. Mm. That was it. Because that monkfish was so fresh and so simply prepared, it sounds kind of like obvious, right? Because chefs always talk about, like, well, you know, you need just the best ingredients,
sure,
simply prepared, and they will be delicious.
Sure.
And it's true.
Mm-hmm.
But even for me, getting this piece of monkfish tail, it was, like, the perfect example of that. It was delicious. Brilliant.
Where was this?
It was at a restaurant called Cal Pep in Barcelona. It's fairly famous. They do mostly seafood preparations. You sit at the bar. They have some tables in the back, but really the action's sitting at the bar. I got a chance to get some of the spirit of the Barcelona tapas experience. I got to try as many of the iconic kinds of Spanish things, like, or whether it's a sauce or a whole dish, as I could in a very brief time, so at least I'd have some taste memory of, like, what I was shooting for.
And so you come back here and you start thinking about constructing the menu. What are the profiles and the characteristics that you want to bring to your menu at that point?
I knew there were some linchpin kind of things that if we were going to be Spanish, we had to have. At least in my mind, we had to have jamón serrano.
Mm-hmm.
And in a fairly straightforward, simple way.
Sure.
We had to have, you know,
manchego cheese.
We had to have manchego cheese. We had to have tomato bread. We had to have patatas bravas. So then the question was going to be like, okay, how are we going to serve those things? And how are we going to do them in a way that I think is going to be interesting? And in a way that's going to set us apart from other Spanish tapas restaurants in Chicago.
Sure, take something like a patatas bravas, which is pretty iconic in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
You know, basically with your aioli and your tomato.
Right.
How do you approach that comparatively?
Most of the time, patatas bravas are like chunked up fried potatoes that get tossed in the tomato sauce, and then there's some aioli over the top of them or something. And coming from this, like, slightly more fine dining, fancy pants culinary past, we thought, well, what if we make it self-contained? So we cut little cylinders of potato and hollow them out partially, and then fry them twice so it's like a really fancy French fry, and put the tomato sauce inside the hollowed out portion and put the aioli on the top, and then you have a one bite self-contained brava. So you have all the flavors of patatas bravas, but in, you know, just presented in a way that you're not accustomed to seeing, and it just looks a little more refined and kind of cute and fun.
I was wondering about the space.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this space when it was mod and now, you know, Suhail, I know, has been the designer of both, and probably, you know, just looking at it now and remembering when it was mod, I mean, probably two of the most interesting architectural spaces for restaurants in the city of Chicago. I mean, he does a really, really different thing than most people do, and, I think, I remember talking to Paul Kahn at Blackbird, and he was talking about, you know, his space is very, it's very, you know, straight, mod, contemporary, very
mm-hmm.
simple. But he was talking about how his architect had an influence on his cooking. And when he started at Blackbird, his approach, you know, he had worked for Erwin Dreschler at Erwin, and he had worked for Rick Bayless. And
mm-hmm.
so what we see today, which is more like a modern take on Chez Panisse and all of that, it came out of the architecture for him. I thought that was really interesting because he's talking about how this architect would just start teaching him about simple and clean lines and things like that. And I wonder how much the space, even when it was Mott or even now, if that influences your cooking at all, or if that...
Well, the space at Mott, the food at Mott when I got there was already very much a juxtaposition of the food and the room. Because the room was so designed to be so like hyper-modern, Jetson-y kind of thing. And the food was this like really green market, farm-driven, simple American food in many respects. And some people thought that, that was a really cool thing, that there was this juxtaposition between the food and the room, and other people just thought it didn't make sense. So when I came to Mott, I kept up with that sort of thing. When I first got there, I had this idea that I was going to go in more of a like Grant Achatz direction and be like, well, look, let's embrace the fact that we have this ultra-modern room, and I'm going to serve everything in like gelatin form and, you know, deconstruct things into weird ways. But it was quickly apparent that that wasn't really going to work out. Mm-hmm. You know, like nobody would have wanted to eat that at Mott. They wanted a big steak or a big pork chop, and that was going to be what they wanted.
It was still more of a neighborhood place than a destination necessarily in that sense.
And as for here at Del Toro, I mean, to a degree, the way the food looks has been influenced by the room, I think, because I wanted to make sure that the food was going to seem appropriate in the room. You know, it's one of the reasons why if you come in here and you look around, it's very, very stylized. Mm-hmm. So some of the things, like the Bravas, for example, needed to be more stylized maybe than they typically would be. There was a lot of stuff made originally out of the fact that we had a dish on the menu when we opened, which was a tureen of octopus, a tureen of saffron braised octopus, and when you cut it, it looked like a mosaic of octopus, mm-hmm. right? And so there was mention of that a couple of times being similar to all the tile mosaic work that we have here, but at the time when I first put it on, I wasn't thinking that. Mm-hmm. It was a happy, you know, coincidence. But.
Which brings up reviews. Mm-hmm. You've gotten pretty good reviews. I think the one that I remember, which I thought was kind of funny, and I'm curious how you as a chef think about it, where like Phil Vitale, you know, he gave you a pretty good review, but he talked about how you were maybe over-aggressive with the salt.
Well, you know what? The review that Phil Vitale did was very, very nice and very complimentary about the food. If you read the review, he says words to the effect of, none of the dishes was a particularly like strong offender in this regard. Like none, but some of them verged on being over-seasoned. And you could, when I first read it, I thought, oh, man. Oh, he's saying my food's salty. But then I reread it, and I said, well, he's saying that they come close to being too salty, but that none of them was too salty, so this is almost not a bad thing. That's almost saying, like, I nailed it. You know, like, I got it real close to the edge, but I didn't go over the edge, so is that a bad thing? I do see his argument about if you were eating course after course after course, that it could get a little bit much over the course of several different plates. And I gave it consideration, and, you know, I've tried to keep an eye on myself and the other cooks to make sure that we're not getting carried away, because it is something that chefs are known for.
Uh-huh. You know, I was just looking at the menu, and I was looking at it online, and I was curious about, you had a cured pork loin on there. I'm curious, do you guys do that in-house? How do you cure it?
We have done it in-house. Uh-huh. We sell so much of it that at the moment we don't have the space to do enough of it to keep up, honestly. I did a whole bunch over the winter when the temperature was a lot easier to deal with and things. It came out very nice. We liked it. We thought it was good. I have some other stuff right now, what we'll call Spanish mountain bacon. I've heard it referred to as that. It's essentially pancetta. Mm-hmm. I took some bellies from Gunthorpe Farms, and I'm curing some downstairs in the wine cellar to make pancetta, mm-hmm. just because I like having it around. And we also have actually a ham hanging downstairs. Mm. my sous chef, Robert Levitt, wanted to take a stab at making a Serrano or prosciutto style ham. So we have a Gunthorpe Farms leg hanging down there. We'll see how that turns out.
That would be interesting.
Yeah, we'll see. That's one that has a high possibility of not working out. But, you know, it'd be fun to try out.
So, I mean, you like this food. I mean, is this something you want to continue to do? I mean, I know, I'm sure in the short term for sure. What's your personal style? I mean, you know, that's the thing is you come into these settings where I know that you've constructed this menu, but it's also a style that, you know, you're going to call a place Del Toro. You know, it's going to be tapas or it's going to be Spanish, you know.
I have a very eclectic palate from, like, the Indian food growing up and a lot of Asian experience in eating Asian food and things. And I really love Mexican food when it's done well. I love all these different things. And cooking one kind of food has... I don't want to cook fusion food necessarily, you know. I'd like to be able to incorporate all these different flavors that I like. And over the years, I've been managing to find ways to incorporate them that strike me as not being fusion necessarily, not really being gimmicky or anything, but being getting closer to being able to put forth a really good explanation of what I like to eat, you know. I don't think I've been in a position yet where I could just cook whatever I want. I've done a fairly good, I'd like to think I've done a pretty good job of addressing the cuisine that I've been asked to cook and doing it honestly and producing some food that I think has genuine merit.
What would you do at home? I mean, I know you don't probably cook at home a lot because it's like doing your job.
Yeah, I do sometimes.
But if, you know, let's say you were you had this idea for a dish or something that you thought down the line you might do, or it would be your style, what would you cook? Or are there experiments that...
I've done little Indian experiments like cooking fish sous vide, but doing Indian preparations that way, which poaching fish in masala pastes and things, but doing it in sous vide bags so that you have the advantage of that very non-traditional Indian cooking technology applied to Indian flavors. And that's something I've been interested in. I don't know that I would ever open a restaurant that was the focus or anything. I would love to do, one of these days, I'm going to get some lamb shanks and do a vindaloo preparation of lamb shanks, and I want to sous vide them and cook them like that.
Sounds good.
Because we know that a sous vide lamb shank is delicious.
Sure.
And usually when you get something like a lamb vindaloo, it's like chunks of lamb shoulder or something that have been stewed in it. And I think you could make a really delicious and elegant preparation of lamb vindaloo with a nice lamb shank and sous vide it.
Your wife, I know, she has a boutique here, and she's a fashion designer.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering if that has any influence on like some of the stuff she does, if that informs her cooking at all, or if you've thought about some of the things or get inspired by anything she does.
I get inspired to feed her.
Yeah?
That's about it. She, Lindsay has always been my most honest critic,
sure.
I suppose.
Sure.
She is incapable of faking it.
Mm-hmm.
If I make something and she doesn't think it's absolutely up to what she understands to be both of our standards, she'll be the first one to tell me, like, yeah, it's not good enough.
Yeah.
Which is kind of a drag sometimes when we eat at home and I'm not trying to get, like, I'm not going for a grade here. I'm not trying to be impressive. I just want to eat dinner and not drive myself nuts over it. And early on in our relationship, sometimes I'd cook stuff for dinner and she'd look at me and be like, I don't know that that's the best risotto you've ever made. Darling, I love you. I was not trying to make the best risotto I ever made. I was just trying to make us dinner. She's eased up on that some, but at the same time, knowing how high her standards are, when I make something and she really likes it, I know that, you know, whether I thought it was good or not, I feel more vindicated if she eats it and she thinks it's really good.
Yeah.
And she has that more, like, normal person approach to food, whereas I have this, like, kind of food geek approach to it, where if she likes it, she likes it because it tastes good. And she doesn't care if it took me 3 days to make. She doesn't care if it was cooked at 147 degrees for 20 minutes and then put in an ice bath and blah, blah, blah. No, she could care less about that.
Right.
If it tastes good, then she likes it.
So you're on death row. you're a chef, you know it's your last meal. What do you eat?
Yeah, that's a tough one. That is a tough one. Might be barbecue.
Yeah?
Yeah. Very, very good possibility to be barbecue. There's just something about slow-cooked, smoky pork and tangy sauce that is never ceases to please.
Mm-hmm.
That said, I could also really probably go for a masala dosa or chicken tikka masala or something like mm-hmm. that. Really good barbecue. I just love, love, love.
Is there an iconic place or a dish that you've had barbecue-wise that you just remember? Or yeah?
I went to the North Carolina Barbecue Festival one year and wandered around eating one pulled pork sandwich after the other. And I don't know, I mean, any chance I get to go, like, my brother lives outside of Nashville now, and I went to visit him last year, and we got off the plane and immediately went to the best barbecue place that I could find online. I looked at a bunch of them, like, well, this one sounds good. It's got the best reviews. Everybody seems to like it. We're going to go there, and we're going to get brisket, because that's what they do best. All right? Okay. That's what we did. And sit down, and it's all, you know, like picnic tables in there with checkered rubber top tablecloth and a bag of white bread and a roll of paper towels, and I figure that's a good sign.
Yeah.
All right, this is going to be serious. It's not going to be fancy, but it's going to be serious.
What was the name of that place?
I don't even remember.
Yeah, I don't remember.
It didn't matter.
It doesn't matter.
Like, they all sort of run one into another. I recently went and tried Honey One Barbecue on Western on one of my days off the other day. I had some ribs there for lunch. They were really good. I go to Fat Willy's a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I think they do a really good job. A pulled pork sandwich at Fat Willy's, I'm happy.
Yeah.
I got no problem.
Are you more of a sweet or spicy barbecue guy?
I like a little bit sweet, spicy, but I also do like North Carolina, like real vinegary style.
Yeah.
It, which you don't get much outside of North Carolina, like not done proper, I don't think.
What about like Kansas City? Not really. I'm more.
It's okay.
Yeah. It's, you know, that if you want to start a war, you start talking about barbecue.
Yeah, start talking about. That's why I like pretty much all barbecue. I can't think of any barbecue I've ever had where I was like, that's just gross.
Yeah. Throw in a dinner party. You can cook for anybody living or dead. You know, who would you want? And maybe you're not even cooking. Maybe you're just throwing a dinner party. It's people you want to hang out with and talk with. Who would it be? Anybody. It could be anybody. Lots of people.
Who would it be? Having a dinner party. I'd definitely invite Renato because he was always a lot of fun. I'd get a kick out of him. Jeffrey Steingarten, maybe.
Oh.
I really get a kick out of his stuff. He might be a little bit much to have dinner with.
Sure.
But
if you're looking for Honest Critic, you'll certainly
get
out of
Jeffrey absolutely.
Steingarten.
I think he would be interesting just to have dinner with. I don't know. I might end up not liking him as much.
Sure.
As I like his writing, but
if you watch him on Iron Chef, he looks like he's a little bit more pompous than he comes. I mean, he's
a great
writer. Like,
yeah, and I love the stuff that he's written. I love his attention to detail and his willingness to follow things through really
mm-hmm.
carefully. Steve Albini, I'd probably invite because he would certainly make the evening interesting. Somebody might throw something at him before the evening was over,
sure.
But that's okay.
What do you think you would ask Steve Albini?
What would I ask Steve Albini? I don't know. I recorded a record with him. My band came out to Evanston, and we recorded an album at his house.
Nice.
Several years ago, when he was still doing bands at his house.
It's funny, you and Nirvana produced by that.
Yeah, actually, he let me play a guitar that Kurt Cobain had used on recording when he recorded with him. It was just like this crazy all-aluminum guitar.
Uh-huh.
The neck was aluminum. The fretboard was aluminum.
Huh.
The whole thing. It had a really cool sound. Obviously really brittle and trebly, like
sure.
you'd imagine, but
sure.
when you layered it in with other guitars, it sounded really good. Joel and Ethan Coen, maybe.
Yeah.
I really like their movies a lot.
Yeah.
But that might just be kind of dorky, because I'd be surrounding myself with all these people whose work I really like, and I could sit there and be like, dude, I really totally loved it in that movie when you did this. I'd turn into Chris Farley.
Yeah. You know, the thing I didn't ask, and I guess is just worth a conversation, is the small plates phenomenon, the whole, you know, I know you guys are tapas, but, you know, it's still, that's where small plates came from.
And, sure.
You know, why do you think that's so popular in America? I mean, is that something that people really want, or is it just a phenomenon? It just seems so, it's like everywhere now. I mean, even more so than ever.
Right. That's a really good question. Is it something that people want, or is it something that we have
in the industry kind of created and told them they want, so they're buying it. I don't know. I would say that it seems to me that the small place thing started to gain traction partly because of the increased popularity of chefs and what we do in general, and therefore also the increased popularity of like the tasting menu, which is nothing more than a series of small plates that was put together by the chef and put in a certain order by the chef. And then the small plates thing is sort of like saying, well, here's a bunch of stuff, put your own tasting menu together. And that I really like, because I love the idea of going to a restaurant and getting to try as many different flavors and textures as I can. And, you know, that's obviously because I'm a food nerd.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like a much more interesting way to eat. I hope that people remain more interested in it, because I think that it will help control portioning a little bit better, where people don't come into a restaurant and expect, like, a 16-ounce slab of meat. I think it'll be more and more. I think it's just a more interesting way to eat. I don't know if it's going to stick. Mm-hmm. People are going to remain interested in it, but I kind of hope that it does, because it really it frees up the diner to put together an experience that they want more easily and with a broader spectrum, and it frees the chef up to cook dishes and not be sort of saddled with the starch, vegetable, sauce, primary protein, entree model.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I appreciate you doing this.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thanks
a
lot.
Yeah.
Hey, I hope you enjoyed this first podcast for Chicago Magazine. Check out www.chicagomag.com or www.hungrymag.com for more food interviews. And in the meantime, hey, stay hungry.
Three, two,
one more time.